Welcome to ICTJ's podcast series, where we discuss transitional justice developments from around the world. This time, we are talking to Pamela Hogan and Ginny Retteke, two of the three producers of a five-part television series called Women, War and Peace, which is to premiere on October 11th on PBS. And the series highlights the changing landscape in conflict and post-conflict societies today, where the women form the majority of victims, but also play a key factor in post-conflict peace building and recovery of these societies. Pamela and Ginny, very warm welcome to ICTJ.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
The series reveals how we are now seeing in the last several decades this dramatic shift in how conflicts are executed, so to speak, in terms of who the targets of violence are. And we have moved from conflicts where soldiers would be the primary victim, so to say, dying on the battlefield, to where civilians and among civilians, women and children are those most vulnerable. Can you tell us from your insight that you've gained through the filming of these five episodes, which look into scenarios in Bosnia, Colombia, Afghanistan, and Liberia, what are the underlying factors? What is causing this phenomenon of women being the primary targets of violence?
One of the biggest factors is the incredible explosion of small arms trafficking. You can get an AK-47 in most countries for, you know, a bag of sugar. And this is something that's changed since the end of the Cold War, where there was kind of, you know, there was a regulated traffic of small arms during the Cold War, and it's just completely disappeared since. And so that's, and there's no treaty and no will on anybody's part, it would seem, to create a treaty. So that's been a huge factor.
Yeah, and I also think that during the Cold War, that one of the things that happened was it kind of kept a lid on things, and so that there's been a lot of conflicts that have risen up since the end of the Cold War. And for me, my experience is when I was in Liberia filming, when we first went there to film Pray the Devil Back to Hell, I mean, I remember thinking, okay, if Charles Taylor is the bad guy, then Lourdes must be the good guy, because I kind of very narrowly thought of conflicts in that way. And then I soon realized that, no, there were no good guys in the fight, that really what it was about was that there was diamonds at stake, there was rubber at stake, there was trees at stake, and so there was a real fight over the resources, and that basically it was a fight between thugs. And as Pam said, that with the access to weapons and with the no longer this lid, the kind of superpowers keeping a lid on things, these things exploded. And I think women have become targeted because it's not the object to actually kill people, because you need the labor, so it's an object to control the population. And if you rape a woman in front of her entire village, you control the village. And so I think that's part of it.
At the same time, we are aware that women have been targeted in conflict, especially when it comes to rape as a weapon of war throughout history. But it seems that now we, are more aware of the practices that are used, so to say, the systematic nature of these campaigns of violence, and B, that they are taking place on a larger scale. If we look at Bosnia, for instance, your first episode focuses on this phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, rape has always been a part of war, and something that happens in war. It's always been thought of as sort of an unfortunate byproduct of war. And then what changed with Bosnia was that you know, the mass rapes that were being committed as ethnic cleansing against the Muslim population just shocked and outraged the world and the international community, and actually became a driving force behind the creation of the Hague Tribunal, which was the first international criminal court since Nuremberg. Rape is not something judges don't like to particularly hear these cases. Lawyers don't really like to prosecute them. Witnesses don't like to talk about them. It's been the great silence. But there was this moment during the Bosnia War when the women who had experienced this horrible torture of themselves and their villages said, we will speak out. We will go to The Hague. We will allow ourselves to tell our experience. And then there were prosecutors joining forces with them, female prosecutors in many cases, saying, we will work with you. We'll create an environment where you'll be safe to speak, a witness protection program. You won't have to reveal your identity if you don't want to. And we'll, make it possible for you to tell your story.
Mentioning Congo, we are actually talking about the effects of ongoing violence, unfortunately, ongoing warfare. On women. In your series, the episode on Colombia captures that really well. Can you tell us more about what you found to be the main effects on women in such circumstances, how this ongoing warfare affects women in communities that are victim to ongoing violence?
I'll draw on my experience in Liberia again, because that conflict went on for such a long time. Women sometimes in war can have a mobility that men cannot. For instance, in Liberia, if men went out on the street, they could have been forcefully conscripted. If a guy that was in either Taylor's army or Lord's army said, I don't want to do this anymore, they get killed or put into jail. So when the women demonstrated on the field and demanded that the warring parties go to the peace table, they didn't want any men there with them, because they knew if that happened, they would be attacked. And so they were able to move and do things that men were not able to do.
And talking about Liberia, I think that Pray the Devil Back to Hell has shown what miracles can come out of women organizing and advocating for peace and getting involved in peace building after the conflict. Yet, women are still represented in peace talks only to some 3 percentage points of all the peacemakers, so to say. Where do you think, based on your experience, women should go in making sure that they have impact like they had in Liberia? And maybe for those who have not seen the film, to talk about this phenomenon that took place, where women actually forced those who made war into peace.
The women were very strategic, and I'm sure exactly how you play that strategy would differ from situation to situation. But what they did in Liberia was that they got together women that had families in both sides of the conflict. They said, we're going to stay out of a political discussion. We want one thing. We want peace. And we're going to demand it from both sides. They're the ones, they can go figure out how they're going to get there, but we're demanding that they do it. It wasn't like, okay, they said that and then it happened. I mean, they had to continue to fight to the point that, like, the negotiations, I think, that were anticipated to go on for 2 weeks went on for 6 weeks, while the men were bombing. They would kind of call the battlefield from the negotiating table and say, well, I didn't get what I want, go bomb this, and maybe tomorrow I'll get what I want, until finally the women in frustration surrounded the hall that the negotiations were going on in and said, we're not letting you out until you come to an agreement. And, you know, that there was a lot of press there, so the press saw what they were doing, and when they were threatened with being arrested, they said they were going to strip naked in front of the world. It worked great there. I mean, you know, I think that, you know, I don't know if that strategy would work if there were no cameras, if it would, you know, so I think that the strategies that people use really differs from situation to situation. But I also know that one of the questions that I've asked a lot of the women in Liberia is, how are they brave enough to stand up to what they did? And they kind of say, well, they were really, they were up, it was either there or dead. I mean, so I think that when there's a lot on the line is when people really do move, and sometimes it takes getting to that point for it to happen.
And on that note, what lessons do you think that can be drawn from that experience that can be possibly applied to other contexts?
One of the big things that happens in these peace negotiations is that resources are divvied up for rebuilding the society after the conflict. And oftentimes those are international resources that are flowing into the country because that country is spotlighted at that moment and everyone wants the war to stop. One of the people that we talked to in our film is Patrick Kamert, who had been in charge of peacekeeping units in a lot of war zones. And, you know, his recipe is give some of the money to the warlords. Just divide it in half. Give some. You have to pay some people off, but then give the rest to women and the members of the society who didn't make the war, were most impacted by it, and have some really good ideas of how to pull together, heal, and rebuild.
On that note, what are the lessons that you believe international community should learn and apply in view of this shift in the outcomes of conflict and the way that civilians are target and the women's role in it all?
I mean, one of the simplest, most concrete takeaways for me from the research we did and what we learned from talking with people in these films is that if you involved women in the demobilization when the guns are brought in to a central checkpoint and people are given some money for turning in that gun and stopping waging war, if you would involve the moms, the grandmas, the aunties, you'll have a more honest process, because that right now that process is generally handled by the UN not in consultation with the community. And didn't something incredible happen in Liberia when the women did become part of the process?
Well, the women actually fought to be part of the demobilization process, and the UN actually said, no, we've got this, we know how to handle this. And they said, listen, we've been through this numerous times in Liberia. And so what happened was the first day of demobilization, all these guys came. There was more people that showed up with guns than was anticipated. They were hanging out, smoking pot, drinking, and it was hot out. They stood in line for hours with guns, and it started to get pretty nasty. In fact, to the point that the UN withdrew and left the women to kind of handle the situation, and the women got the guys to calm down. I mean, they knew them. They were their, like their relatives. They were their friends, and whatever. They were from their community. And they basically calmed the situation down. It took them 4 days, but then they regrouped. And after that, the UN then began to work with the women and ask them how that they could help demobilize, what languages need to be, where the guns were. But, I mean, I think of what Pam was talking about that Patrick Merritt said. I mean, just think about it, that most demobilization processes means that, and this is happening in Afghanistan too, you try to lure the soldier off the field with the promise of a job, and you'll give them money for the gun. So what can happen in a community like where there's been atrocities committed, you have a guy that's committed atrocities that's being paid to come back, he gets a job and he gets money, but the people that he's committed the atrocity against, for instance, a woman who was raped, who might have been kicked out of her family, who might have lost everything, she sees that this guy comes back to her community and is given prestige, is given a job, or whatever, he's forgiven, and she's got nothing. Why not, as Pam said, that Patrick Kamert said, give the warlords or the men with the guns a certain amount of money, because you have to do that, but then say the real programs are going to be controlled by it has to be an organization, and we're going to have, and women will have representation on this, and it is not going to be the guys who made the war.
Yeah, I think in the broadest way, what we're looking at is that if you spotlight women and include this as part of the story of war, and understand that this is a resource in a war zone, then you see that actually women have a really strategic role to play. The military is starting to realize this. They've created female engagement teams in Afghanistan because they realized that when the men were in there going, you know, from door to door, they weren't able to talk with 50% of the population of Afghanistan. You know, and this is something that Hillary Clinton said in her confirmation hearings to be Secretary of State. She said, I am looking at women as a foreign policy issue. I'm taking it off the humanitarian part of the plate, and I'm moving it into the middle. This is security, and this is foreign policy.
Well, we have been speaking in ICTJ's podcast series with Ginny Retiker and Pamela Hogan, who together with Abigail Disney produced the series Women, War and Peace, which is to premiere on October 11th on PBS. We wish you all the best with this project and you, everything that you are doing, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ruby.
Thank you very much for having us.